Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker for today, RCVS and European Specialist in Small Animal Surgery, Ronan Doyle. Thank you, Ronan. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Great. Thanks for that. Thanks for the introduction. And hello, everyone, to this webinar. Yeah, so should be interesting. Hopefully, over the next hour or so, we're going to talk about surgery in this location. This was one of those key areas for us as a vet to deal with any issues around the bottom. And the focus really of the webinar is to look at three key things. We're going to look at, I suppose, in a bit more detail, the anatomy in the area, because it's, I think, a site that holds a lot of fears for us, a lot of worries. So we're going to look at that in more detail and maybe understand better what the anatomy around there is and what the concerns that can be. We're going to look at, in a bit more detail then, about that, the concerns, the challenges, particularly that can arise with surgery in this location, and how, as surgeons, we try and keep control of that. How we try and manage those challenges as best as possible. And a lot of the surgery is sort of trying to stay in front, trying to avoid, obviously, problems and contamination being the key one with the location it's in. And then we're going to look at some of the diseases, some of the surgical diseases of the location, and particularly also look at some of the key surgery in this site with a focus on surgery of the anal sac. So, So I've mentioned what the plan is: surgical anatomy, surgical challenges, surgical diseases. When we think about those diseases, I say we're going to spend a reasonable amount of time talking about anal sac disease. Not so much about the impaction, because I'm sure we're all very used to managing those, but instead more about patients that require surgery for problems here. We'll look at anal frunculosis, perianal fistulation, you know, issues there, a bit about anal perianal neoplasia. If we have time, some of the less common things like anorectal prolapse or congenital problems. So, looking at the anatomy first, nice picture here. Might as well get up front and in focus. The anal location. We've got let's get this point up. We've got obviously anus. We've clipped a lot of hair around this location, and we can see that sort of hairless skin in the perianal situation. For the focus of the talk, so we're going to look at perianal disease, and that's going to be really the most terminal bit of the rectum, this junction of where rectum meets skin, so that mucocutaneous junction, and a little bit of that area just around it, that hairless circumanal skin. We're not going to look at, you know, things that are out a bit further, like perineal diseases, so perineal hernias or otherwise. And we're not going to go deeper into the rectum itself, but plenty to talk about in this location, as we'll see. So, thinking a little bit more about the anatomy, let's see what we got to say about that. Yeah, so let's look at this man here. So this is a very eminent human proctologist from the middle of the last century. Walter C. Bornemeyer, and he published this now very famous quote for people who are thinking about surgery in this location. And you can see, as it says, "So man has succeeded or animals fail because of the clever use of his hands, yet, compared to the hands, the external anal sphincter is far superior." And then this comment, which is obviously true: "If you place in your cupped hands a mixture of fluid, solid, and gas, and through the opening at the bottom try to let the gas escape, you fail, yet the anal sphincter can do it." And then this lovely comment about no other muscle is such a protector of dignity, it's so ready to come to his relief. I say it's actually quite a well-known quote for people working in this location. But I thought Justin Caffs looks perfectly. You see him there, he's just thinking deeply about the anal sphincter there in that photo. But let's look more, because this is, I mean, it's when you think of it, it is incredible what the anal sphincter, what the structures in this area are able to do, the way that they control. And obviously with that, if there's a problem, that massive concern about fecal incontinence and how that can be such a potentially disastrous complication for ourselves as surgeons, most definitely for the patient, but particularly then for the owners, because of the challenges of living with a pet who has a problem of that nature. So let's spend a little bit more time just looking at the anatomy at site. So I've made up a little diagram of this. We're going to take a cross section through this sort of site here. I'm just going to look at the different zones and the junctions between skin to the rectum and then the surrounding structures around it. So bear with me. This is one of my own drawings, so you'll have to use a little bit of imagination. What we've got here, say this is a cross section taken through the anus. So we've got the hair skin here on the outside, here, followed by the rectum mucosa on the inside. And the hair skin is just that, it's hair skin, surrounding then coming into the hairless skin, which sits in this area, the circumanal skin. And it's a classic location, like at the mouth or in other spots, where we've got to go from the rectal mucosa to the skin. So it's a mucocutaneous junction. And we have this specialized area, which is called the anal canal, where the two things meet. And then I'm just drawn in here, so the deeper rectal wall, just pressed here. We then have an internal anal sphincter. So the rectal wall obviously is in layers, there's mucosa, submucosa, and then muscularis. And the terminal rectal wall, so in this area here, we have thickened non-voluntary, so smooth muscle, circular muscle, which makes up this internal anal sphincter. And that's under involuntary control. It's normally holding things in a closed position. It's supported by the external anal sphincter. And the external anal sphincter is a striated muscle, and it surrounds this whole site. But it's a combination of two sphincters which give control in this location. Within the external anal sphincter, embedded within it and actually lying between it and the rectal wall, we have this sinus of skin, which is called the anal sac, or obviously in common parlance, often called the anal glands. But as we know, it's an anal sac, so it's lined by skin, a little duct, which opens out just in front of the anal canal, or just behind the anal canal, because it's caudal. And then this goes quite deep. We think of this often on palpation, that it feels quite superficial, but actually, this is the direction it is positioned in. It goes very much cranially and adjacent to that rectal wall, and the deepest portion of it sitting actually quite far cranial in relation to where the anal sac duct is. More on that later when we look at doing anal sac surgery. Then also, I suppose, along with the external anal sphincter, which is here, we have the levator ani muscle and the coccygeus muscle, which is here. And these three muscles, coccygeus, levator ani, and external anal sphincter, make up what we call the pelvic diaphragm. which gives outer support to the rectum on defecation. And we know if that ruptures, then you can end up, particularly if it ruptures with the levator ani, you end up with a perineal hernia due to pelvic diaphragm rupture. Important one to be aware of, because if there is a rupture of the pelvic diaphragm and bulging, then we can end up with something, structures either the rectum or maybe even the bladder or prostate, which can bulge through and end up as a swelling that sits out here in normally just a fat-filled space, the perineal fossa. So you can get swellings that sit out further lateral to the anus in the perineal fossa, which you might think are associated, say, with the anal sac, but are actually due to perineal hernias. The key characteristic of those is when you push them, you can generally push them back into the direction they came, and then you put your finger away and they pop back out to position again. And on rectal palpation, you get a feel for that as well. But we're not talking about perineal hernias in detail today. That's for another talk. But just to give some context. Okay, let's look a little bit closer at this mucocutaneous junction. So we have rectal mucosa, which then goes to this columnar zone of rectal mucosa, which is the terminal portion of the rectum, just in this area of the anal canal. And then there's a very, very thin line called the intermediate zone, which just runs here. So if you look very, very closely at this junction, you'll see this thin line which separates the cutaneous skin, hairless cutaneous skin, from the columnar zone of the terminal rectum. So it's a thin line, about a millimeter wide. And just caudal to that, we'll have the opening of the anal sac duct. So that's where they will open. Okay. So this is this specialized area. This anal canal, this area here, has an excellent nerve supply, because to control continence, control defecation, it's important to be able to feel that there is a rectal, there's a fecal stool coming down to this location, and that actually these muscles need to contract. A loss of sensation in this area leads to a loss of fecal continence. It leads to dropping pieces of feces, or maybe feces just sort of trickling out of the area, because there isn't a sensation, contraction of the external anal sphincter or internal anal sphincter is necessary. So really quite delicate tissues with a fantastic nerve supply, which are important, obviously, for continence. Okay. Just thinking about the glandular structures, when we talk about the anal glands, we know we're actually not talking about the anal sacs per se, you know, as professionals, I to get our terms right. Well, the anal glands are actually these mucoid secreting glands that sit in that columnar zone, secrete a little bit of mucus that's very useful then on defecation, because it helps to just smooth and facilitate that passage of the fecal stool through the anal canal. If there's a lot of inflammation in this area, you might get more mucus. Sometimes if there's a tumor in the location, we get a lot more mucus, and that's generally being secreted from here or possibly from the further up in the rectum. So those are actually what the anal glands are as compared to the anal sacs. And the anal sacs do have glands in them. They have these apocrine glands, which are within the wall of the skin, essentially skin. It's stratified squamous epithelium, which lines the anal sac. And it's these apocrine glands that produce the secretions, which are so smelly, and dogs particularly interested in when they like to smell each other's bottoms or smell stools and so forth. Well, it's coming from these glands. And it's also these glands, we know, which are implicated in the development of anal sac tumours, or apocrine gland, generally adenocarcinomas of the anal sac. So it's those little tiny glands that line the anal sac which develop into those rather nasty tumours. You can get other types of tumour of the anal sac, so you can get squamous cell carcinomas of the anal sac, although they're much, much less common. Okay, let's look at, oh yes, before we finish, the circumanal glands. So that hairless skin that sits just around the bottom, we've got these sebaceous glands, these circumanal glands, which are situated. They're the glands which, in an older dog, the skin in this location, the anus can look very prominent, very hairless, and you can sometimes have a very large sort of circumanal area evident. So particularly an elderly, you know, male entire dog have a really obvious circumanal skin, and that's because of hypertrophy of these circumanal glands. And it's those glands that can go on to develop into perianal adenomas or adenocarcinomas, which we'll touch on later on. Okay, so that's those circumanal glands, the true anal glands, and the apocrine glands of the anal sac. Okay, let's have a quick look to finish. Oh yeah, sorry, we looked at that there. There's that cutaneous hairless skin, the circumanal glands. There's two zones to that. There's an inner and an outer zone. It's in the inner zone that you get the anal sac duct openings. There'll be one of them about there, probably. Just shows you here, things look a little bit inflamed in this location, but that's that little line that sits there. That's the intermediate zone there. That's the columnar zone of the rectum. So just an indication of the anatomy here. I mentioned earlier on, actually, if we had a perineal hernia, you'd expect some swelling out in this location, this area here we call the perineal fossa out here. Not to be confused, obviously, with a mass that might be associated with the anal sac, which is going to sit here. Okay, now let's look at the nerve and the blood supply, particularly the worries with the nerve supply, because this can be one of these things that really concern us in relation to the development of incontinence. So we've got the pudendal nerve, which essentially is the key thing that supplies sensation to this anal canal, and also supplies voluntary control of that external sphincter. So this caudal rectal nerve that does this, and we have a perineal nerve that supplies the sensory. So really important. This caudal rectal nerve particularly important. One on each side, obviously, but innervates that muscle. You see how close that can be to the deepest portion of where the anal sac is situated. So that's an important thing to bear in mind when we're removing the anal sacs. We want to stay in close to the sacs. We don't want to go too deeply, potentially traumatize that nerve. We have one on either side, though, and you can manage just with one nerve. There will be some cross-innervation from the other side, or re-innervation, and will develop. So if you only traumatize one side, you'll get away with that. If you take out both caudal rectal nerves, you've got a problem with continence. But also as important, to maintain sensory sensation to this anal canal. Interestingly enough, many dogs, after they've had surgery, there may be quite a lot of inflammation in this location. And the inflammation means that there's a decrease in sort of sensation or impaired sensation to this area. And some dogs will then have a sort of a very temporary soiling of the perineal or perianal region, which is normally only lasts for a couple of days as that inflammation settles down. And that's normally due to, you know, changes in the sensation in this location. Okay, looking at the blood supply, we've got the internal pudendal artery. This is mirrored by the veins, but internal pudendal artery, which then supplies a caudal rectal branch, again, supplies rectal wall and then a perineal branch, which supplies external anal sphincter. So really, really good blood supply to the location, particularly to the rectal mucosa, anal canal, external anal sphincter. So it's something we need to be quite aware of when we're doing surgery. Okay, so that's the anatomy. Quite a bit of it. But hopefully gives us a much better feel for the extent of things, where things are, what things look like. Next time you get an opportunity, look much more closely at that mucocutaneous junction, and you can really see that difference between the rectal mucosa, anal canal, cutaneous zone. See where those anal sac duct openings are, and they'll always, you know, sit in the same place. Get a feel for, you know, what the area of the external anal sphincter muscle is, where the internal anal sphincter is, and then just you just need knowledge of where those nerves and vessels are from the point of view of when you do surgery, so you don't go wrong. Okay, let's look at some of the surgical challenges. So, key challenges here are this worry, this risk of fecal incontinence. We've touched on it. Also, potential concerns with hemorrhage. And finally, worries with infection and dehiscence. Now, incontinence, we'll just quickly touch on the causes, potential causes of that, and how that might relate to, you know, whether they apply or don't apply to surgery in the location. Hemorrhage, we just need to be careful with our dissection and have means of controlling hemorrhage if that occurs. And infection dehiscence is all about, I think a lot of it is about preempting, keeping in control in surgery, setting things up well to try and minimize contamination, and then thinking about our plan to deal with that should that occur. So, fecal incontinence, just quickly recap about how continence is maintained. We've got the storage function of the colon rectum. So, if you've got a patient where you've had to remove the colon or the rectum, you're going to have problems with just continence because the feces will just come straight out. It's not stored and then formed into a nice fecal stool. We need closure of the anal sphincter. We looked at that, external anal sphincter, internal anal sphincter, and we've got this conscious and unconscious control. And then ultimately, we're going to have incontinence if there's a problem to that motor supply to the anal sphincter. If there's no sphincter muscles present, clearly. If we lose anal canal or perianal sensation, we talked about that a moment ago. And then if there's a loss of storage capacity. So, you know, we can see here where, yeah, these are all concerns. Although to get actual incontinence due to loss of sphincter muscles, you have to remove more than 50%. So we get away with a lot. We can remove, you know, 30-40% of the anal sphincter and still maintain generally good continence from the opposite side. It's more particularly about making sure we don't damage the nerves and that we maintain good sensation in the area, which is important to control things. If we end up having to remove all of the anal canal and, you know, say there's a big tumor there and we're bringing the rectal mucosa right out to that, you know, skin, we end up with problems with control because we lose sensation in this location. So, yeah, lots of potential causes, but hopefully puts that into a bit more context rather than just being a big bogeyman fear. We can think about how actually that can occur and whether these are concerns or not for us when we do the surgery. Hemorrhage, good dissection. I find using electrocoagulation, so this is using here, it's just a picture of bipolar diathermy. I find that very useful. Using swabs, lavaging and on occasion to remove blood clots, all very, very useful to maintain good visualization of this surgical site, particularly so when we do anosaccolectomy. And good lights, really key for us, good surgical light, so we can really shine deep into the area. And then we look at infection dehiscence. This is all about setting things up well to manage things. So we want to minimize contamination, and this is about trying to prepare the patient well, evacuating the rectum prior to surgery, packing the rectum if necessary, or putting a purse string suture in if it's appropriate. It depends what we're doing. If I'm doing surgery which is going to actually involve the terminal rectum and I'm not able to put a purse string suture in, so say there's a polyp or something. We're not particularly going to talk about these, but in those sort of scenarios, I'll be aiming to starve these dogs for 48 hours. I'll give them some colonic preparation, as we would do for colonoscopy, 24 hours beforehand. And on the day of surgery, try and make sure that that's actually settled down. If it's got, you know, heavy diarrhea, then actually it may not be the best day to do this. We may need that to settle first. On the other hand, if we're doing surgery of the perianal skin, so say a perianal adenoma or anal sacculectomy, then, you know, less issues in relation to having to prepare the patient. You know, there will be feces in the rectum, and we might need to just digitally evacuate that when under GA. But then what I'll do is I'll place some packing in the rectum to prevent feces from coming out, and particularly if there's liquid sort of elements of the feces. And what the purse string suture is doing predominantly for me there is, rather than completely closing the rectum and holding it, sorry, the anus and holding it closed, what it's really doing is it's holding the packing in position, so the packing can then absorb and prevent any feces from coming out through my wound. Purse string suture still needs to be tight, but it's more to hold the packing in position. So I very, very rarely would use a purse string suture without packing. Purse string suture without packing, feces, if the patient, you know, tries to defecate, it will defecate through the purse string suture. So you need the packing as well. Diarrhea we mentioned, probably need to postpone. Perioperative antibiotics, yes, I do give antibiotics or perioperatively here because it's risk and contamination. The question is more about, do we need to follow with postoperative antibiotics? Generally not. So perioperatively, I'll give them a broad spec antibiotic intravenously. So normally I'll use a second generation cephalosporin like cefuroxime, so that's Cinacef, and I'll give that every 2 hours when it's under, from induction to while it's under GA. I don't generally follow with antibiotics in the postoperative period unless there's a really good reason to do so. If it's more rectal surgery, I'd probably be adding in metronidazole to that as well. This area does tend to heal quite quickly. It's just trying to sort of minimize the amount of antibiotics or unnecessarily using antibiotics, because the worry here is if we use antibiotics when we don't need to, we'll end up selecting for resistant bacteria, which could then get in there and cause a problem if the wound dehisces, and then we've got a resistant bacterial population, which is more challenging to deal with. Copious lavage, really important, off the site, and then careful closure. Careful with our dissection. Careful avoiding tension. And then just, you know, doing layered closures to try and manage tension as well as we can do. And usually using absorbable suture material. Well, in fact, yeah, predominantly absorbable suture material here because of that risk of infection. The absorbable suture material, often use something which is relatively short-acting. So, things like polycacaprolol 25, so that's monacryl or similar, maybe on occasion polydioxinone, so that's PDS or similar, to just manage it. Okay. So let's look a little bit about setting this up. This is a dog. I think we're about to do anal sac surgery on. You can see we've actually given this dog an epidural as well. It's had a small epidural or a small clip for an epidural, which has helped numb this area. Very useful technique. So probably had a combination of an opioid and a local anesthetic for that to help to minimise our anesthesia required and keep the dog nice and comfortable as it recovered. We've wrapped up the tail. Now we're just going to flush the anal sacs. So I'm using here a spirul needle and just a syringe with, that's probably a dilute chlorhexidine solution, just to lavage. And then this is putting in our packing. So this is just a couple of rolled up swabs. I've got a suture material which I've used to tag this really well. I don't want to lose these swabs. Covered it well in KY jelly, the bit that's certainly going to be in contact with the mucosa. Then we'll just push it into location. So that just sits there in that rectum. We'll then place our purse string suture, and it depends what we're going to do. If we need access to the anal sac ducts, then I'm going to place this just cranial to the anal sac ducts, so in that sort of columnar zone of the anal canal terminal rectum. If I need, I'm in that area here, in that area just around those anal sac ducts, which are here. So you can see this is what we're doing here. This tissue is tolerant to placement of purse string suture here. But say the key thing, remember, the purse string suture is to hold the packing, not actually to prevent feces coming through. The packing is doing that. If I wasn't worried about the anal sac ducts, if I was, you know, operating more in the surrounding area, then I'd come a little bit further caudal, more into this cutaneous zone for the purse string suture. So there it is now into location. We've got one piece of suture material which is attached to the, I said probably this one here, probably attached to the swab. And this piece of suture material is where our purse string is. And this is a different dog, it's just showing you how it's positioned. We've got it in a frog leg position here. It's in sternal recumbency. We've got the tail tied up and positioned. Kind of keep the dog nice and warm, so it's got one of these air blankets, warm air blankets, to manage it there, a bit of bulb wrap over the top. This position is quite good because for perianal surgery, because it avoids putting too much pressure on the hips or on the area just in front of the hind limbs. This is not, so you can see just here, clipped out these long pieces of suture material attached to everything. It's out of the way. This is an alternative. This is for when we're doing more perineal surgery where we need to get further distal. And this is where we'll have the legs off the table. Puts a bit more pressure on this area here, and that's why we'll put extra padding across here. We know if we don't pad well here, then you can put pressure on the femoral nerves and end up with temporary paresis or paralysis issues. So we pad out really nicely. But mostly, I say, for perineal surgery, it's this type of arrangement which I'm aiming at. Because we're in sternal recumbency, there can be a bit more risk of gastroesophageal reflux. So you need to be aware of that. Potentially, we'll give these dogs, an antiacid medication like omeprazole. Okay. So here we are all set up. We've now got our drapes in position. We've got towel clips holding the drapes, and actually, because these towel clips then fall out of the way, you need a towel clip to hold up the towel clip. This is quite handy. This is a plastic sort of pouch thing. It's not essential, but it's quite handy just to put in underneath everything, because we'll be lavaging quite a lot, and it just helps to catch the lavage fluid. We're normally sitting right behind this, and otherwise that can fall down onto your knees, which is a bit uncomfortable. You see here we've got good access to the anal sac ducts either side, so we can do what we need to do. This would have been anal sac surgery that we're about to undertake here. If it's surgery of the anal rectal canal, so you can see here, this is a dog which has a tumor here of the terminal rectum anal canal area. We mentioned surgery on 48 hours, no food, 24 hours colonic prep. You need to be very clear what your goal is with these. These are surgeries that can very easily get out of the way or out of control. So very clearly need to know what this is, need to know what margin we need to achieve, need to have good expectations of what the outcome is going to be. These are the dogs that, if we're not so sure, we go off track, we start exciting a lot of tissue, you can end up with a dog which can end up having serious complications, particularly fecal incontinence problems, and an owner that may not be prepared for the severity of those. So I have to be very, very clear about what our undertaking is. You can see here we're using lots of stay sutures on normal mucosa and on the tumor itself. These are required to give us control of the surgical site. So they're essential for us. And this type of surgery is all about maintaining that control for us. We can then excise these at their base and then reconstruct or There's different sort of ways to do that, or do a sort of a pull out, pull through of tissue if need to be. But again, the more surgery we do here, the bigger resections we do, as you go, you know, more to 270, 360 degrees, the higher risk of complications associated with that. So we're not going to spend a major amount of time on that, just to say, you know, something like this, you want to biopsy first, and then we don't normally scope the rest of the colon as well, make sure and rectum, make sure there's nothing else going on. Okay, let's move on to some of the anal, surgical disease, and particularly we'll look at anal sac issues. So, okay, anal sac disease, well, let's not teach us to suck eggs with, there's the classic signs, obviously, you know, scooting, discomfort, licking around the perianal region. The thing to do, though, is just keep an open mind, because they're, you know, dogs can present classic signs of anal sac disease or anal sac impaction or anal sacculitis, and normally that's the case. We know that's really, really common problem. However, there can be other issues that can show with the same signs, so things like anusitis, which is just inflammation of the anal canal, which I've seen on occasion, and that can be associated with a mucocutaneous junction problem or just a localized problem in this area. You've seen that in a few cavalier king charleses over the years. Proctitis, so inflammation of the rectum, fleas, you know, dermatological diseases, it's just uncomfortable, you know, pruritic around this area, parasites, neurological disease. So all the potential causes, which we just need to be aware of. Okay. But obviously anal sac disease predominates here. If it's disease, so rather than just an impaction, which we can normally manually evacuate, you know, obviously we're used to doing that, our nurses are, everyone basically is used to doing that, and the smell, and I'm sure we all have an anecdote of where a junior colleague has done that, it's gone wrong, and secretions have gone all over the place. But when it actually moves on to developing into an infection, an anal sacculitis, this is where we may have more signs. And particularly if it goes on to develop an anal sac abscess, we might actually get systemic signs. So pyrexia, you know, maybe. I've seen dogs with severe anal sac abscesses, you know, having a marked you know, septic type sort of response to that, associated with the fact that they've had a big abscess present. If it's anal sac tumors, you have to be careful, because although you think most of them will present with anal sac signs, local signs, the majority of them, or many of them, certainly don't. So clinically, it can look very silent. And they may be very silent until they're very large locally and really starting to seriously impact on defecation. So many anal sac tumors, particularly this is the anal sac apocrine gland adenocarcinoma, they're small, and then they get gradually larger. They don't show any signs until they cause a problem. We often see these dogs because they're dogs who have had chronic anal sac impactions, and then they've been picked up on a routine, you know, emptying. We've seen them because, you know, vets have included an anal sac assessment as part of an assessment of the older dogs, so dogs over 8 years of age, as part of the routine health check, just checking the anal sacs, and then they pick up anal sac masses. So we see more as a consequence of that. And then we see some because, look, they're just massive and they're causing a problem. Or we're seeing them because of the other problems you get with anal sac tumors. They are, have a high risk of metastasis. And we're maybe picking up large lymph nodes, and they're causing difficulty defecating. You can have a really small local with a really big lymph node. Or we know that a number of these can develop paraneoplastic problems associated with calcium management, so this PTH, our thyroid hormone-like hormone, which can then cause hypercalcemia. Okay, so that's science. Okay, let's quickly just say we're all pretty comfy here, but classic impaction or, you know, mild sacculitis, obstruction to the duct. It's maybe due to the individual anatomy or due to some stricturing or due to scarring, perhaps due to previous infection or injury, or it could be because there's inflammation of the skin here, or of that junction, or an anusitis. Therefore, we've ended up with some obstruction. So just aware of potential causes of that, or diet change, obviously, can be another reason. So the fecal stool consistency has changed, and it's ended up more prone to developing anal sac impaction. So there's no disruption to emptying. Mentioned potential causes, maybe very sedentary dog, so isn't defecating as frequently as it should do. There could be more secretion, particularly this is with an infection, so there's a purulent discharge, which is potentially, again, predisposing to problems. The classic, obviously, you know, pasty, you know, appearance is just your impaction. If it's more purulent, then that's where I would, you know, veer into the sacculitis. Okay, manner expression, uncomplicated, maybe resented, generally, you know, routine, regular intervals, so forth. Okay. If it's annual sacculitis, generally painful, distended gland, may vigorously resent expression, may need to actually sedate this dog or GA it, short GA it so we can properly assess it. We express it and we get a purulent discharge or bloody discharge. I don't normally culture these, but if you do, you end up with generally, you know, a coliform or similar, you know, bacteria you'd expect in this area. This is an actual infection which is occurring here, as compared to just the discomfort of an impaction. These are, you know, sacs that we need to carefully express, normally under sedation or GA. We'll cannulate and do some lavage. We might put in a topical antibiotic treatment, and, you know, if your husband's got a favorite thing they'd like to use there. There's an argument, perhaps, to give systemic antibiotics, you know, a short course because of the inflammation that's in the area and the infection that's in the location. We might get them back in and repeat this, again, depending on how it's progressing. Generally best to get them back at some point, post periods, just to make sure all is going well. And if this is becoming a frequent problem, or it's not improving with treatment, this is where we then start to consider surgery. So just important to bear in mind that difference between an impaction versus an actual sacculitis. And once you start to get frequent sacculitises, often with a prior history of impactions, that's where you can start to get into problems. Is often there's then being scarring and change to the anal sac duct, and they're predisposed to developing repeat infections. Abscess, well, really severe infection, really distended gland, then ruptures, and ruptures generally caudally, so you end up with a sinus tract and, you know, significant discharge. You can sometimes end up with a significant local cellulitis. This dog actually, when it came in, nearly looked septic in its nature. It was markedly pyrexic. It was actually developing a marked systemic response associated with this. We got that to settle down, you know, with appropriate treatment, and it needed systemic antibiotics. But then, you know, we ended up with this significant local abscess, actually had significant cellulitis. We just dealt with that locally, but ultimately knew when they do this, there's a high risk of recurrence. So when dogs develop this sort of problem, might get away with it once, but in general, if that recurs, then we'll advise towards surgery. Or if it's this sort of severe, once everything's more settled down, we'll look at doing surgery to remove that anal sac. I've seen the occasional dog where, rather than rupturing caudally, it's actually ruptured cranially into the perineal fossa. And that was a challenging, because you get a lot of inflammation in that location. So that's uncommon, but I have seen that occur. And then you have to sort of dissect quite deeply in there to sort of manage that. And obviously, as we saw earlier, that's where some key nerves and blood vessels are as well. So that's a bit more difficult. So let's look at anal sacculectomy. We've referenced it here on a couple of occasions in management of these patients. The idea is this is going to be a cure. We're going to remove the anal sacs, which are causing a problem. And we can consider doing this two techniques, is doing this in a closed manner or doing it in an open manner. There is a risk of complications. And actually, Tim Charlesworth has a really nice paper from a few years ago now. It was in Journal of Small Animal Practice, looking at these risk factors in association with bilateral closed anal sacculectomy. So real nice study that he did. It was about 90 dogs or 94 dogs or so. And in those, about a third had minor short-term post-op complications. None of them had any major long-term, you know, problems, incontinence, major dehiscences. But the short-term things were things like a little bit of soiling of the perineum afterwards, a little bit of discomfort location, a little bit of mild to moderate inflammation of the location. Smaller dogs, higher risk. Dogs where these were all closed anal sac lectomy, so they hadn't opened into the anal sac. So where they'd used a filler to distend the sac, they had a higher rate of complications. But still, that rate was low. You know, they were, I think, looking at somewhere between 3 to 8% around that sort of level. And their just comment was, look, warn owners of risk of short-term perineal soiling, expected to resolve within a few days. Permanent damage is low risk. Well, this is all about the surgeon, all about being careful. We saw earlier on the anatomy and you know, where if we go too deep, if we're not in the right location, go off track, we can quite quickly get into vessels and nerves and so forth. Okay, so, you know, Tim's quite an experienced surgeon. So he's a very experienced surgeon. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose we just have to be careful with those complications. So let's look at setup here. So we saw this earlier on. Okay. So with a closed anal sac lectomy, here I am using a probe. So it's a blunt probe placed into the anal sac, down the anal sac duct, and I'm just palpating where that sits. As you can see, where that sits there, just beneath the skin. You could use a filler. When we use a filler, we tend to use something like this. Actually, a colleague of mine here in the practice, he likes to light a few tea lights just when the dog gets pre-medded. So you get a nice molten wax. She then uses a cut-down IV cannula, green IV cannula, to cannulate the duct. Pops that in the position, quickly draws up the wax, so the molten wax, into the syringe, and then squeezes it in to the anal sac. And you know what wax is like when it's in contact with your skin? It very quickly solidifies, so it's not going to burn through that anal sac, but it is a nice filler. I mean, there's commercial fillers out there in the market as well, but we always know when, say, if a colleague's going to be doing one of these surgeries, because there's a helix on and atmosphere in the induction room. Okay, then here we go. That's in position. I would just quickly squeeze it in. So that's with if you're using a filler. Now, without a filler, and this, as you're seeing in this patient, we've just got a probe in position into the anal sac, and then just beyond that hairless zone, that circumanal zone, into the haired zone, you make an incision through the skin. And the probe is helping us to identify where the anal sac is itself. So a little bit of deeper dissection then. You can see here we've got someone holding the probe, or you can try and do that with one hand while you dissect with the other hand. And we'll use, you know, something like this, a curved Metzenbaum scissors, or I particularly like to use a curved mosquito hemostats, so blunt dissection, just down onto the anal sac wall. Anal sac wall here. We then will put in some Galpi retractors here. You need an extra tail clip just to hold those in position, but they're in position just to help hold it open. And then just keep dissecting around that anal sac. You find that sort of junction of external anal sphincter onto the anal sac wall. And carefully dissect those fibers off as we go deeper. Until we've fully dissected out the sac, as you can see here. The most challenging bit is the deepest location where you have to carefully dissect it off the sphincter, and also then medially where it's closely associated with that rectal wall as we saw in the anatomy earlier on. You can see here we've just grasped it with a curved hemostats, a little bit of tension, a bit of deeper dissection. And now what we'll do is we'll ligate across the base here of the anal sac duct, and yeah, see, we're ligating across. We're putting a little transfixing ligature in here, and then removing, and looking carefully at it after it's removed. Quite common in our dissection that we may end up rupturing into it. We don't worry about that. We just make sure that we don't leave any portion of the anal sac behind, because if we leave any of that anal sac epithelium, high risk that that's going to cause a problem subsequently. Okay, and then lavage, and then closure in layers. So deeper suture, and then subcut suture, and then you can put skin sutures in, or often I'll put an intradermal suture in, and then some glue on the surface. Yeah, put a glue there just on the surface, so you can see here what it's like here. I've done this on both sides. You can see this wound here. We've now cut the purse string suture. We're going to remove this swab. And you can see there all this poo, which we've held back with it. And then just a careful feel just inside to make sure that all is well. Open anal sac laminectomy. This is a dog who'd had an anal sac abscess and fistula on this side. And open can be useful for those patients because just to help go into the deeper tissues. Otherwise, let's just see. So yeah, actually this is it. We're going on this side, so we'll put a probe down the anal sac, duct into the anal sac. Now we're going to cut along that probe down through the anal sac duct, through some of that external anal sphincter muscle, right down into the anal sac itself. When we do that, you can see here that inner surface of the anal sac, which just looks like specialized skin. Just looks like skin. And once we're in there, then we'll start to dissect that clear from the underlying muscle. The advantage of this is you can clearly see what you're dissecting, because you're seeing clearly that skin, that surface, and then you just carefully dissect that clear from the deeper external anal sphincter. And then what I'll normally do is this, I'll attach little forceps, skin hemostats to the cut edge. They just help to sort of open out the anal sac duct, and then just as we dissect deeper, we work through that. And then once it's removed, again, just check to make sure it's all been fully excised. And then we'll lavage and close this up. And there's again, this is with an intradermal suture. Okay. So that's closed and open anal sac lectomy, the two techniques. Both techniques are fine. Both techniques have different modifications, or particularly with the closed, whether you fill or you don't fill. Both involve careful dissection free from the external anal sphincter, and that just careful knowledge about staying close to the anal sac, not going too deeply cranially, where you then might end up close to the nerves that supply the anal external anal sphincter. Okay, it's removed. Let's look at anal sac tumors. We briefly mentioned their clinical signs. They're nearly always adenocarcinomas of the apocrine gland, we've mentioned already. Normally dogs over 10 years of age, no particular gender predilection. One report showed that nearly 40% of these dogs have been diagnosed incidentally. They're mostly unilateral, but there are reports of bilateral anal sac tumors. They're not spread from one to the other. They're just both arrived de novo. But that's important to be aware of. Now, despite that, I still just remove, I just find it on one side, I'll just remove that on one side and monitor for the long term on the other side, because the majority don't end up with bilateral disease. The reason I don't operate bilaterally up front is because if it's a challenging surgery on one side, I don't want to end up in a situation where I've damaged the nerves on one side and then potentially damaged them on the other side, and then I'm with an incontinent dog. So it's going to be these are more challenging surgeries when we do it on one side, and therefore we have to just that bit more careful. I mentioned hypercalcemia and early metastasis can occur. Importantly, the size of the tumor, you can get really small primary tumors like grain of rice size, but massive sublumbar lymph node metastasis. So the size of the primary doesn't indicate metastasis, or you can get massive primary tumors like, you know, grape to larger size and no metastasis. We know that about 50% of dogs when they present to us will not have metastasis, but of those 50% who do not have metastasis, about 50% have metastasized, we just haven't seen it yet. So they subsequently develop signs of that in due course. This is an area where actually we're going to be getting a whole lot more information on in due course. We're contributing to a really big worldwide study being done by the Veterinary Society of Surgical Oncologists, and you know, hopefully that's going to end up like a study of 800 to 1,000 cases, and that will be a fantastic study because we'll have lots of information, really good groups telling us a lot more on how these patients respond to treatment or how they progress with their disease. Diagnosis on palpation, finding last route very useful because cytologists can clearly tell anal sac tumors from other types of tumor. And we'll need to do some staging, ultrasound, or particularly useful to assess lymph nodes, or CT, also very useful. Chest x-rays to check. Abdominal x-rays, not good at ruling out sublumbar lymph node mets. So if you're doing abdominal x-rays, you also need to do ultrasound, or alternatively, you do a CT. We'll also check liver and spleen, which will be a further site of dysmetastasis, and also the lungs. We'll also check renal function, calcium levels, importantly looking at ionized calcium rather than total calcium for them. Just quickly, hypercalcemia. Concern hypercalcemia is the concern that it can cause renal dysfunction. Those who have calcemic generally have PUPD, and that might be the key initial clinical sign and helps us diagnose the anal sac tumor. So older dog with PUPD would check for an anal sac mass. And then from a surgery point of view, two ends to that. If there's a local tumor, we excise it with a closed anal sacolectomy and working around the tumor to remove a little capsule of surrounding muscle, which can end up removal quite a bit of the muscle. And if there's metastasis to the lymph nodes, we look at removing those because we know removal of the lymph node metastasis gives a significant survival advantage than if we leave them. But that all depends on the size of the lymph nodes and how straightforward or not that will be. And that's a challenging surgery because of the location that they are situated in. Sublumbar lymph nodes sit just at where the aorta goes into the external iliacs and internal iliacs and where the similar veins are. And therefore, it's a very busy area, lots of important blood vessels and challenging location to operate in. So this is just a dog with an anal sac tumor. Not very much when we sort of poke it from the outside. When you put your finger in and feel it, pretty reasonable size mass here associated with that anal sac. FNA, that will confirm adenocarcinoma. We do a closed anal sac tumor. This is a different dog. It's got an anal sac tumor here. And this is, again, from the outside, nothing very obvious, but on palpation, something present. Closed anal sacolectomy, we can just see deeper here. Here's the mass. Carefully work around that to dissect that free from the anal, external anal sphincter. And this is it here after it's removed. That would have been here. That's the anal sac. Here's the mass around it. Blood. Bit of muscle as well. It's been removed. So much more extensive, much higher risk of damage. Much more care required. These are normally not locally invasive. They're normally relatively encapsulated in relation to the surrounding structures, but you have to be very careful in our excision. Okay. And this is just an example of CT, just showing a really large here sublumbar lymph node. And that sort of thing can still be excised. We just need to be very careful when we do that. You can see these structures here are iliac vessels. And just an intraop picture here. There's a lymph node we're working out. These are large vessels. This is the sort of thing we look like after we're removed. And we know removal of those gives the survival advantage for these dogs. Okay. Too much of this, but just basically to mention. Adjunctive treatments afterwards. Yep, a lot of debate. And hopefully this further study will give us more information on that. We know chemotherapy isn't very useful preoperatively, but can be very useful postoperatively. Potentially, there's enough data to support that, I think. Radiotherapy is the other treatment as well, which can be used for these patients. And again, there's a reasonable amount of support for that, but we're waiting for, let's say, the bigger studies that will hopefully shed more light on that. Quickly then, we'll just finish off perianal neoplasia, so perianal adenomas. So this sort of story here. This is an older male dog. You see lots of obvious non-haired perianal skin, really prominent perianal skin, and they can develop these hypertrophy of the circumanal glands that then go on to develop into tumors. They're normally adenomas in most dogs, normally in the entire male dog, but it can also occur in other female dogs or neuter dogs, closely associated with androgenic stimulation, so testosterone. Adenocarcinomas can also occur, and actually cytology is really useful to distinguish between them. If it looks angrier, if it looks ulcerated, worthwhile FNA to make sure it's not an adenocarcinoma, because if it is an adenocarcinoma, they need to be excised with a wider margin. They need to be completely excised. Whereas an adenoma, if they're small, you may just get away with castration and they'll regress, or small local excision and castration will resolve these. Perineal fistulas then, very quickly, classic breed, German Shepherd. We know it's associated with an immune-mediated issue, particularly associated with their T cells. We know this from their response to immunosuppressive therapy. Classic clinical signs, pain, tenesmus, dyschezia, and these ulcers and deep sinuses. So there's its anus there, these deep sinus tracts, often associated with the anal sacs as well, but normally a secondary involvement rather than actually a primary issue. So we know there's a T-cell dysfunction. That's primarily because of their response to T-cell suppression with medication. This is now primarily a medical disease. Lots of surgical techniques. You look at the textbooks, there's lots of things described. None of them work very effectively. It's not our mainstay of treatment. Instead, we're looking at management with immunosuppressive therapy, primarily cyclosporins, but also potentially you can use a topical T-cell inhibitor, sort of a dog here, classic sort of German Shepherd, horrible sort of ulcers and deep sinus tracts. There's the anal canal there, pretty horrible mess. We start on cyclosporin. This is it back. Sorry, I've been out of focus here. This is it back. 4 weeks later, we've seen a good improvement. We'd expect a good improvement within 4 weeks. It may not be completely resolved, but we expect a good improvement, and then we'll follow on with continued therapy. And normally these dogs, actually within a week of starting treatment, they will be much more comfortable. You get a secondary bacterial involvement, so we'll often need to treat that as well. And anal hygiene is important, so you know, getting the owners to flush and shower and so forth, wash the areas, is important. If they don't respond to treatments, we've got ongoing issues, we'll assess for concurrent lower bowel disease and manage that as well, and that can help. Many of these dogs need long-standing treatment. And where surgery comes in is really just about trying to excise residual tracts. So this dog here has got a couple of little residual tracts up here. Or if there's anal sac involvement, and where the anal sacs have been infected and then maybe had a fistula associated with that. So we'll look at removing those. This is just a dog here with retreated medication. He's ended up just with a couple of little chronic tracts and granulation tissue. And we're going to look at excising these along with the anal sacs. Done that in an open manner and then just closed up what we can. So this is where the anal sac were here. Excise these. And then the other areas here we've debrided, removed any underrun skin. We'll just let heal by second intention. This is the dog. 2 weeks later. Slight amount of excessive granulation tissue, but this is healing in quite nicely. Now, this is actually in a collie. You get these occasionally in other non-German Shepherd breeds. For those dogs, often they do respond to good long-term treatment without then requiring medication, but many of the Shepherds will still need a sort of a chronic low-level treatment with cyclosporin. Very quickly, just finishing on anal rectal prolapse. So this is just a classic one in a cat here, anal prolapse, usually associated with fecal tenesmus due to different reasons. Assess them, replace it. First episode, that might be okay. Recurs, then we'll try and aim to find the underlying cause for the tenesmus, so that's often diet or parasites, and then we'll put a purse string suture in for a few days. Loose enough that they can defecate through, but not so loose that actually it can prolapse. Normally add in a laxative as well to aid defecation. And after a few days, normally they can be removed. We'll use a monofilament, you know, nylon type sort of suture for that purpose. This is the more serious one, significant prolapse. We've had a major prolapse here of rectal wall through the site. These ones, we need to try and deal with this pretty quickly to get that back into position. You have to just be careful looking at the viability of this. Be aware of the possibility that could be an interception. So this could be intestine that's come all the way down through here. So we just put a little probe along the side. If the probe doesn't go in any distance, then it's a rectal prolapse. It goes in a long distance. We worry about an interception. If it's devitalized, we may need to excise an anastomose. That's a bit challenging. Otherwise, we'll try and put it back, put a purse string suture in, and we might consider a colopaxy where we pull the colon cranially and then anchor that to the body wall. Again, assess for underlying. So this cat, really, it's really edematous. Covered it up with some. This is a super saturated sugar solution here, and use that to sort of shrink it up a little bit. And then I've just very, very carefully with gloves, and lots of lubrication, just carefully worked it back in. Pop back into position. Very mild mucosal trauma, but mild. See the why the external sphincter is here. We're then going to put a purse string suture in that. See here. And then I'm going to take this cat to surgery. I want to anchor that colon forward. So this is caudal, this is cranial, this is the colon. Bring this cranially. And then we're placing sutures here between the colon wall and the left body wall, making a small incision or just scarifying the surface of the serosa. Same thing on the transversus abdominis muscle, and putting sutures between the two. I'm trying to keep this rectum here under tension to try and prevent it from coming back out again. Okay, cool. Okay, key thing though, assess for underlying. You get these odd cats who have this challenge where they have this sort of chronic anal mucosal prolapse. They can be tricky to deal with, and I'm quite interested in these. I've looked at the technique and I've used a couple of patients which has been sort of a modification of a human technique. So not very common, but you get these odd cats who do this, or sometimes over time they may do this frequently. It's just mucosa. And then over a few months that settles down. But I've had a couple of cats where that's been an ongoing long-term problem, and we've looked at using a sort of a human technique where we place these sort of what's called anapexy sutures for that. Okay. I think we're done. So nice clean white snow after all that very anal talk. So thanks everyone. That was our tour of the perianal region and looking at key factors of perianal surgery, particularly looking at anal sac surgery. So any questions, any things there? Ah, okay, got a question here. Just a quick one about which type of anal sacolectomy do we do and when? So that's a really, really good pertinent question. So just to recap on that, I suppose I primarily will do a closed anal sacolectomy for most patients, unless it's a patient which has perhaps got an anal sac fistula. I find them useful to do an open anal sacolectomy because there can be a lot of scar tissue around it and may be difficult to identify the anal sac wall, and opening the anal sac, as we showed, clearly identifies that inner surface and that makes it easier. Similarly, if it's due to patient with perianal fistulas and I need to take out the anal sac, I'll do an open normally for that purpose. But otherwise, if it's patients, certainly with a tumor, I'll do a closed. For most patients where I'm doing, say, an elective type anal sacolectomy, it's normally a closed anal sacolectomy, just because reports indicate slightly lower rates of complication, and that nice report looking at fillers and non-fillers, I don't tend to fill these days and just tend to use a probe when I do that. Great.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Ronan for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.